In the previous presentation, we saw that another issue that was dividing the community in Corinth was what to do about food that had been offered to idols, food that after the offering would be in the marketplace to be bought and in homes to which the Christians might be invited, and what were they to do? This problem, as you know, was first noticed back in Antioch, where the community were first called Christians, because they had Gentiles and Jews together in the one community. And it was so important that they gather as one, significantly for the Eucharist. And so in the Council of Jerusalem, a decision was made to ask the Gentiles to refrain, when they gather in together in a community, from eating food that had been offered to idols. Here in Corinth, the situation was reversed in this sense that they were mostly Gentile, though a significant number of Jews, of course, too, in the community. So the Gentiles, some of them, who probably the same group, thought they were wise and thought they were free, and they said, look, it's all right, there are no such things as gods. We don't bother about where the food comes from. And that was a reasonable point of view in a way. But there were Jews in the community who were very sensitive to this and who had been brought up all their life to not eat such food. And so that was one of the issues they mentioned in the letter to Paul. What are we to do? Well, this is Paul's answer then. He says, look, it's chapter 8, verse 7. It's not everyone who has this knowledge that some of them are claiming, knowledge that food offered to idols is insignificant because there are no such things as gods. Not everyone has this knowledge, says Paul, since some have become so accustomed to idols until now, some of the Gentiles had been worshipping idols, they still think of the food they eat as food offered to an idol. And their conscience, being weak, is defiled. Food won't bring you close to God. We're no worse off if we do not eat, and no better off if we do. But take care that your insistence on exercising your rights doesn't somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. For if others see you, who possess knowledge, eating in the temple of an idol, might they not, since their conscience is weak, be encouraged to the point of eating food sacrificed to idols? So by your knowledge, those weak believers for whom the Messiah died are destroyed. But when you thus sin against members of your family and wound their conscience when it's weak, you're sinning against the Messiah. It's a scandal, in other words. Therefore, if food is the cause of their falling, I'll never eat meat, so that I may not cause one of them to fall. So Paul is concerned for the little ones. He stresses the fact that to sin against their weaker brethren is to sin against Jesus himself. We're at the heart of Paul's conversion experience when on the road to Damascus he heard, I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. Concern for the truth must prevail, of course, so long as we remember that the ultimate truth is that God is love and that he draws each of us to himself where we are. All parties must be challenged to be sensitive to this. Only love can build a community up. The love which Jesus had for us when he gave his life for us. So Paul has been suggesting to the Corinthians that in the cause of love, they renounce their right to eat food that has been offered to idols. He concluded by saying that if eating such food were to cause another to sin, because they see you eating the food, they then are enticed to go back to their former ways if they're Gentiles and start eating food offered to idols. Well, it won't be long before they're actually going to the idol again and remembering what it was like and what they could enjoy as pagans there in the idol's temple. And if they're Jews, they're somehow confused in the community where people are eating food that they've been told all their life they're not allowed to eat. So Paul concludes by focusing their attention not on, yes, being smart or knowing or realizing that no such thing as idols, so the food doesn't matter. He concludes by saying that if eating such food causes another person to sin, well, he himself would certainly refrain from doing so. So precious is the salvation of those for whom Jesus died. He devotes the whole of chapter 9 to reminding the community of the rights which he has willingly decided not to exercise, the better to carry out the commission given him by God. His key point seems to be that just because we have rights, like the people have in Corinth have right to eat any food they want to, just because we have rights, it doesn't mean that we have to insist on exercising them. Underlying this whole section is a challenge. Paul is saying, if I've given up so much for the gospel and for love of you, surely you can forgo your rights for the sake of your brothers and sisters in the faith. So let's explore this argument of Paul. Verse 1, chapter 9. Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are you not my work in the Lord? If I am not an apostle to others, at least I am to you. You are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. This is my defense to those who would examine me. Do we not have the right to our food and drink? Do we not have the right to be accompanied by a believing wife, as do the other apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working for a living? Who at any time pays the expenses for doing military exercise? Military service? Who plants a vineyard and doesn't eat of its fruit? Or who tends a flock and doesn't get any of the milk? So Paul's talking about the rights that he's given up so that he can exercise his love to this, and he did there for 18 months in Corinth. A couple of interesting things that came out in that passage. The other apostles all are travelling with their wife. Cephas is mentioned explicitly. And we know about Peter's mother-in-law from the other Gospels. So he's travelling for his mission, but he's taking his wife with him. So but Paul's given up that right. He also talks about another group that are travelling with their wife in their mission. He talks of them as the brothers of the Lord. So in Jesus' extended family, we know about James, who actually was the chief presbyter in Jerusalem. He was a brother of the Lord, of Jesus, in his extended family. Well, there are obviously others of Jesus' extended family who've joined the Christian community and are on mission. Paul continues, "Do I say this on human authority? Doesn't the law also say the same? It's written in the law of Moses," and he quotes Deuteronomy, "you shall not muzzle an ox while it's treading out the grain. Is it for oxen that God is concerned, or does he not speak entirely for our sake? It was indeed written for our sake, for whoever ploughs should plough in hope, and whoever threshes should thresh in hope of a share in the crop. If we have sown spiritual good among you, is it too much if we reap your material benefits? If others share this rightful claim on you, do not we still more? Nevertheless, we've not made use of this right. We endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ. Do you not know that those who are employed in the temple service, get the food from the temple, and those who serve at the altar share in what is sacrificed on the altar? In the same way, the Lord commanded that those who proclaim the gospel should get their living by the gospel. But I have made no use of any of these rites, nor am I writing this so that they may be applied in my case. Indeed, I'd rather die than that. No one will deprive me of my boast, my ground for boasting. If I proclaim the gospel, this gives me no ground for boasting, for an obligation is laid on me, and woe to me if I don't proclaim the gospel. For if I do this of my own will, I have a reward. But if not of my own will, I am entrusted with a commission. What then is my reward? Just this, that in my proclamation I may make the gospel free of charge, so as not to make full use of my rights in the gospel." A small comment. Paul's wage, Paul's salary, is precisely to have no wage, nothing earned materially. That's why, unlike the other apostles, he supports himself by his own manual work. This is a deliberate choice that Paul makes, but it's a choice he makes in obedience to the commission given to him by the risen Jesus. For him, it's an essential part of proclaiming the gospel. The others, that's fine what they do. That's not Paul's point. For him, he has given up everything to proclaim the gospel. And he has made it very clear he's not using that as a means to support himself. And he states that, "For though I am free with respect to all, I've made myself a slave to all so that I might win more of them. To the Jews, I became as a Jew, to win Jews. To those under the law, I became as one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law, I became as one outside the law, though I'm not free from God's law, but am under the law of Christ. Why? So that I might win those outside the law. To the weak, I became weak, so that I might win the weak. And I've become all things to all people, that I might by all means save some. Paul is faithful to Judaism, though he learned from his Lord that obedience to God required that he be free not to follow the law, when to do so would mean resisting the Spirit of Jesus, guiding him to love. This is what he calls the Messiah's law. Like Jesus himself, it was the needs of the weak that especially drew him. And you can hear his pleading with the Corinthians to forego their rights to food or whatever, to care for the weak among them. Verse 23, I do all, says Paul, for the sake of the gospel, so that I may share in its blessings. Don't you know that in a race the runners all compete, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win it. Athletes exercise self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable one. So I don't run aimlessly, nor do I box as though beating the air, but I punish my body, I enslave it, so that after proclaiming to others, I myself should not be disqualified. This reminds us a little of something Paul said in an earlier letter to the Galatians, chapter 5. He said, you were all called to freedom, brothers and sisters, but don't use your freedom as an opportunity for self-indulgence, but through love, become slaves to one another. And now in chapter 10, Paul goes on to warn them against being too overconfident. Religious experience doesn't guarantee salvation. Their determination to eat idol meat is not only causing a scandal to the weak, it's actually putting their own salvation at risk. So I'll read now chapter 10. I do not want you to be unaware, brothers and sisters, that our ancestors were all under the cloud. All of them passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was the Messiah. Brackets. This is a kind of typology that Paul uses. The rock, God, what the rock was for the Israelites, the Messiah is for us, disciples of Jesus. Nevertheless, God was not pleased with most of them, and they were struck down in the wilderness. Why? Because of idolatry, because they worshipped the golden calf. Well, the Christians in Corinth, anywhere of course, but Paul's writing to Corinth, they need to be careful. It's possible that they too may be tempted and by their behaviour lured back into ways of behaving that they knew and enjoyed as Gentiles. In verse 6, Paul writes, "Now these things occurred as examples for us, so that we might not desire evil as they did. Do not become idolaters as some of them did, as it is written," quoting Exodus, "the people sat down to eat and drink, and they rose up to play. We mustn't indulge in sexual immorality, as some of them did. And 23,000 fell in a single day." The story is found in Numbers chapter 25. "We mustn't put the Messiah to the test, as some of them did, and were destroyed by serpents." You find that story in Numbers 21. "And don't complain, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer." It's in Numbers chapter 14. So Paul's going back and reminding them of the stories of their past. "These things happened to them to serve as an example, and they were written down to instruct us, on whom the ends of the age have come. So, if you think you're standing, watch out that you don't fall. No testing has overtaken you that's not common to everyone. God is faithful, and God will not let you be tested beyond your strength. But with the testing, God will also provide the way out so that you may be able to endure it. Therefore, my dear friends, flee from the worship of idols. I speak as to sensible people. Judge for yourselves what I'm saying." Now, by way of contrast to the meals shared in the pagan temples that they were used to, those Gentiles were used to, and some of the Jews may have, after conversion, gone with them, just not to worship the idol, but to enjoy the food and company and celebrations, etc. Well, now, by way of contrast with those cultic meals, Paul speaks of the Christian meal, the celebration of the Last Supper, their special sharing as a community, their eating together as a community. And Paul writes, "The cup of blessing that we bless, is it not a communion in the blood of the Messiah? The bread that we break, is it not a communion in the body of the Messiah? Because there's one bread, we who are many are one body, for we all partake of the one bread." Paul is speaking of the communion which they have with Jesus himself, who poured out his life's blood for us on the cross, and who gave himself for us in all the many ways that he related to us as man in his human existence, his body. It is our being in communion with Jesus, self-giving as man, that binds us all into one community, and therefore into one body, with all the other participants in the Eucharist. Consider, says Paul, consider the people of Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices partners in the altar? What do I imply then? The food sacrificed to idols is anything? Am I implying that an idol is anything? No. I imply that what pagans sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons, not to God. I don't want you to be partners in communion with demons. You can't drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You can't partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Or are we provoking the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than him? And then he quotes from their letter, which included the words, "All things are lawful." Now Paul replies to that. He says, yeah, but not all things are beneficial. And they insist, all things are lawful. And Paul says, but not all things build up. Don't seek your own advantage. Seek the advantage of the other person. Eat, he says, whatever is sold in the meat market without raising any question on the ground of conscience. For the earth and its fullness are the Lord's. So there's Paul's advice to all of them. Whatever you buy in the market, yes, some of it may have originally gone to idols. You don't have to ask all those questions. It's there in the marketplace. Eat, buy it and eat it, please, all of you. Well, what about eating in someone's home? Paul goes on. If an unbeliever invites you to a meal and you're disposed to go, eat whatever is set before you without raising any question on the ground of conscience. But if someone says to you, oh, this food has been offered in sacrifice, well, don't eat it, out of consideration for the one who informed you and for the sake of conscience. I mean the other person's conscience, not yours. Why should my liberty be subject to the judgment of someone else's conscience? If I partake with thankfulness, why should I be denounced because of that for which I give thanks? So, Paul concludes, whether you eat or drink, or whatever you do, do everything for the glory of God. Give no offence to Jews or to Greeks or to the Church of God, just as I try to please everyone in everything I do, not seeking my own advantage, but that of many, so that they may be saved. Be imitators of me as I am of the Messiah. So Paul offers his own example for their imitation and explains why he wants them to imitate him, because he is imitating Jesus. Paul's solution to the problem facing the Corinthian church is to draw them with him to the foot of the cross, so that together they can contemplate him who made of his life an offering to others in love. So clearly Paul is saying, solving, if they listen, their problem. Don't go to the temples. Don't eat there. That's obviously too difficult and hurtful and tempting for you and others. Don't go to there. But as for food in the marketplace, or in the home, eat it. It's fine. Don't ask the question. Don't get involved in all of that business of food offered to idols in the temples. Just be simple, buy it, ask no questions. But if you actually, someone says, well, look, that was offered in sacrifice, then for the sake of that person who might be scandalized if you eat it, don't eat it, because eating and not eating aren't very significant. Just be sensitive to each other. Love each other. Do what you see is best for the other person.